Okay, so last time, one question arose that I said I would look a little into, and that was the question of whether or not we actually needed the axiom of choice for the theorem that every proper ideal is contained in a maximal ideal in the case when the Banach algebra is separable. And so the answer is, I don't know. However, the usual idea that you would try to use to prove this fails miserably, and I suspect it may not be true, but I don't know. So if you remember what we did last time, we just talked about it. We didn't write anything down. And I think it was Lee who made the the point that we couldn't include invertible elements in our countable dense set, so just ignore them. So what you do is you take a countable dense set of the non-invertible elements. That's always the case in a... Doesn't matter. I just want to take a countable dense subset of them. I mean, that's easy to do. If the big space has a countable dense set, you can always find a countable dense set in any subset. It doesn't require anything. No, all you do is you take a dense set in the big space and consider the family of all balls with radius, say, 1 over n, countable family of balls at each point. You look at the collection of all such balls. For every such ball that intersects your set E, pick a point in it. No, it's still countable. It's countable. Oh, you mean to pick a point of E? Well, if E is closed, then we can pick the closest one to the center. No. If it's closed, the point is compact, and if a closed set, there's a point. You're right. Yeah. Well, certainly not. It's certainly not going to be convex. So maybe even there you need the axiom of choice. But since the rest of the argument fails anyways, what I was going to suggest is that since we don't know the answer, let's just ignore that question and also ignore the question about whether H infinity is separable or not. I suspect it isn't, but now we don't care because even if it is separable, we probably still need the axiom of choice. So anyway, let's just leave that alone. For example, so there will be three compact Hausdorff K, and we'll look at the continuous functions on K with the soup norm, obviously satisfies the inequality that you need for a Banach algebra, and let script M be the maximal ideal space, which is a collection of all complex homomorphisms. So we claim that the map capital P that takes K to script M by point P in K goes to the point evaluation. So that will be, which I'll call phi of p. The point evaluation is just phi of p is just f of p for f in ck. The claim is that this thing, of course, is homeomorphism. So that the maximal ideal space is nothing other than the set on which the functions are defined. So, I guess, what do we do? First of all, the fact that K is Hausdorff Um, implies that implies that C and K separate points. That, of course, implies that C is 1, so that was easy. Continuity also follows easily, just by the definition of the weak topology on M. You look at the basic open neighborhoods, and they're defined in terms of P's that satisfy inequalities with F's. But the F's are continuous. Away you go. So, also, B continuous by definition of topology on M. So it's a continuous embedding, and the only thing that remains to be proved is it's onto. That's the sort of hard part. It's not that hard, though. So remain. Show onto. So suppose not. What does this mean? Then there exists a maximal ideal, M, in C of K, such that M is not equal to C of P for any P. So what does that mean? That means that for every P, remember, M is maximal, so for every P, you cannot have M completely contained in the kernel of the, viewing, I guess, what did I do? I viewed phi of P here as a complex homomorphism. So I should put here maybe kernel. I mean, there's a one-to-one correspondence between the complex homomorphisms and their kernels, which are maximal ideals, but anyway. So thus, for every P, there exists an F in the maximal ideal such that CP of F is not zero, because otherwise M would be contained in the kernel. And since M is maximal, it would be equal to the kernel. That's not the case that we're assuming. I.e., what's this mean? This just means F of P non-zero. So in other words, what this says is that for every point P in our original set K, so here's K, for every P, there exists an F, depending on P, of course, such that F of P is not zero, and of course F is in this maximal ideal. So now we use the fact that K is compact, implies that there are finitely many F's in here, such that at least one of them is non-zero at every point P. So K compact implies there exists F1 to Fn. So this is finitely many continuous functions in this maximal ideal, such that the sum of Fn P, I'll just write it like this for future reference, such that this thing is equal to or greater than delta squared positive for all P. Okay, because FP non-zero means that its modulus is positive, which means that the square of the modulus is positive. I just write it this way because it starts to look like an ideal being generated. And of course, in this case, I could say something simpler, but because of what we're going to do later, I want to put everything in terms of 1. So therefore, if I call this... I'll just leave it like that. So therefore, 1 is equal to the sum n equals 1 to capital N, Fnp, times these things. Fn t bar over, and then it's just the sum of the fn squareds. So in other words, we have represented 1 as a sum of the of these functions fn and k times other functions. And since we're in the space C of k, continuous functions, taking complex conjugate and dividing by modulus squared keeps you in C. So in other words, this is an M. That's because this construction, fn bar over the, keeps you in the space of continuous functions. I just want to emphasize this because this is what, of course, will go wrong if the fn's are holomorphic. This simple construction won't keep you in the ideal. But here, with continuous functions, it does. And, of course, that's the contradiction. Sorry, what did I say? Is an M. That, for all P, that implies 1 is an M. And that's the contradiction, because the unit element cannot be in the maximal ideal.
That's proper.
Okay, so the second example won't quite work with this proof. Let's take dn is the Pauli disk in Cn. I just want to point out that taking n equals 1 is fine at this point, just looking at the disk. But I'm just going to introduce the Pauli disk because eventually we will go to several variables, and we may as well see something proved here very simply. So in this case, we'll define A of dn bar to be the set of F continuous, such that F is holomorphic in the Pauli disk. So, I mean, the picture I'll draw, I'll just draw the case of the disk, of course. So it's a continuous function on the closed disk, holomorphic on the inside. And for this purpose, holomorphic can just mean has a power series expansion, dn over d, centered at the origin. So this with, of course, infinity, is a closed subalgebra of C. So, of course, it's a Banach algebra. It's a closed subalgebra of the thing we just looked at. So let M be equal to its maximal ideal space. Well, the claim is it's still, point evaluation map is still a homeomorphism. So it's still one-to-one continuous and onto. Incidentally, I forgot to mention at this point here, I could have just pointed out, note, just one sentence, the Gelfand transform hat identity. So if you just chase through the definitions, it's always dangerous.
Does that mean this case that is maximal point?
Oh, maximal ideal space. Just the same. The point of these examples is we're supposed to look at 2 things. For 3 examples of Banach algebras, we're supposed to calculate their maximal ideal space and calculate the Gelfand transform. Just pointing out here that the Gelfand transform is kind of trivial. It's just the identity. So, for example, if you look at F hat and you want to know how does that act on an H, See, I'm going to forget all the... But the H can be identified with the point P. I mean, when I say it's the identity, with the identification from the homeomorphism that we just used. So here, when I write H is equal to P, I'm using that identification of the maximal ideal space with the original set K. And then what was this equal to? This was equal to the point evaluation functional applied to F, and that by definition was F of P. So F hat at P is F of P, anyway, under that identification. Okay, so we come back to here, at M equals, and again we have the same claim. Whoops. Right, and here it's everything. Yeah, that doesn't always happen. Incidentally, I remembered, actually, I just looked when I was reading it, that I mentioned the other day that the kernel of the Galfand transform is the radical. And, of course, it's convenient when you can show that the kernel is empty, or it just consists of zero, because you like one-to-one math. And there's an easy characterization. The kernel of hat is just zero if and only if for all x in the Planck algebra. I didn't look at the proof of this, but I remember looking at it years ago. But anyway, so for example, whenever you're using the soup norm, you get this for free from this theorem, which I'm not going to prove. We get the one-to-oneness anyways, fairly simply. I think, the fact that it's equal to F, the identity, is obviously one-to-one, so you get it for free there. And I think we get it for free in the next two examples as well. We don't have to use that theorem. Okay, so the claim M, or once again, phi, which maps d bar n to m, is homeomorphism, where the same thing, it's the point evaluation. So phi of, maybe now I'll write z as the element in d bar n, where phi z is a continuous linear functional acting on an f by, of course, just taking the values, the point evaluation function. Okay, so what do we do for this? So again, phi is one-to-one and continuous. The proof we used last time to show onto is not going to work, because, at least not in this simplicity, because by the time we get to here, this guy's not holomorphic. So we can no longer conclude, we can certainly get to here by the same proof. But at this point, we can no longer say that 1 is in M, because 1 is represented as a sum of functions in M times things that aren't even in your Banach algebra. So to prove onto, we use the fact that polynomials are dense. And of course, the connection with polynomials is that point evaluations are, of course, linear functionals that are multiplicative. If you take polynomials of them, they should just become they're well defined, and their action on an F is just action on a. Oh, let's just write it out. So to prove this, we use the fact that polynomials are dense in here as follows. So let Z equals Z1 to Zn. Now a polynomial in Z, of course, is a polynomial in these individual variables, so let's give them a name. And if we let so now let's set G. Now pick H in M. So here we have a multiplicative linear functional on this algebra of holomorphic functions. And we want to show that H is actually phi of something. It's actually a point evaluation. And the candidate is W, which is H of G1 H of Gn. And you just use the fact that H is a algebra homomorphism together with, if you take a polynomial in W, you're just going to get the polynomial here, which is H of the polynomial in G, which is, so then, from this, if P is a polynomial, we get that P of W is the polynomial of these things, but that is going to be H of the polynomial Z1 to Zn, which is, so that'll be H of G1 up to Gn, because the H's are algebra homomorphisms. Sorry, I missed the P. Where did the P go? So P of W, so the P is now in, okay. Yeah, this is entirely trivial. If you just take the, I just have to write something out because I can't see it this close to the blackboard. If we take the polynomial to be Z1, Z2, then what's P of W? P of W is that. Is this, which by the fact that this is a homomorphism, this is H of G1, G2, which is H of so what is G1 times G2? It's the polynomial at so P of W is the product, that's H of P of Z. I mean, G1 is just Z1.
But so you write that as P of G raised composition.
This is by definition H acting on
H of P.
So this is just H acting on the polynomial P. That's what I was missing over there. Sorry about this. So H of P is just P of W. So P of W is just H of P. Just do the general proof for the one I just did here. I'll hopelessly get lost if I try to do that. Okay, so that means that H, when acting on polynomials, does look like a point evaluation. And now by the density, we're done. Now, given F in the disk algebra, or the polydisk algebra, there exist PKs tending to F in the uniform norm. The way you do that is you just expand F a little bit by an R to make it spill out over the boundary, and then you look at the power series. And the power series is nicely uniformly convergent there. Just take a tail, just take a, truncate the power series at that level, and everything goes. So that's just easy.
Is the function for Morphic K the polygon can continue up to the boundary? Does that mean that they can always, that it will be all Morphic in some neighborhood?
No. So what I said here is, you consider FRZ. And FR is now holomorphic. Consider for, I'm going to choose a little r, close to 1. This function, then F of RZ, is can be approximated by its Taylor series. Because FR, goes off like that. And then you just approximate the two. Okay, well, I'll just leave that as an exercise. So there exists a PK going to F in the L infinity norm. And so, PKW, which is equal to H of PK, this tends to H of F. That's because H is a continuous linear functional. And this goes to F and W. Oh, I didn't say that. That's because W is in the closed polydisc. I should have said that. I guess I can say it now. Since W is in the closed polydisc, because the norm of H is equal to or less than 1 is a linear functional. That's so you stay in the polydisc. Okay, so finally, that's H is phi of W. Okay. So we have it on to I realize I forgot to prove something in the first example, because I was about to think about proving it now. So I'll do them both, because the proof is the same. In this proof here, I showed that phi was onto. So now we have that phi is one-to-one, continuous, and onto from one topology, topological space to another. I didn't show that it was homeomorphic.
But there is a theorem that says there are two compact sets. The function is continuous and onto, and one-to-one. I think it means that the inverse is...
So what you use is the rigidity of compact Hausdorff spaces. It's the best way to think of it. That's what you're saying. And so what we have... So maybe I should just make a remark here about both of these. I'll do both of the proofs at once. I'll just say in both examples above, we have that the topologies coincide by the rigidity of compact Hausdorff spaces, and we'll just say a word about that. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because this spills over into a neighborhood of the closed polygon.
The Taylor series approximation.
Yeah. The Taylor series converge uniformly and absolutely in all compact subsets of the polydisc. So since we're now, okay, if we've expanded it, we're looking at a compact. Or maybe the simplest way to do it even in the first case is instead of looking at F on the boundary, just bring the boundary in a little bit. It's the same thing. Just bring the boundary in a little bit, and use a Taylor approximation there, use the fact that the series converge uniformly and absolutely on compact subsets, and then then F has to be close to its boundaries because it's continuous. So note, in both of these examples, so now we have one-to-one continuous and onto, and that one as well, in both of these examples, we get that K and M, or in the other example, or the last example, D bar and M, a different M, of course, we get that these two things are homeomorphic by rigidity of compact Hausdorff spaces. And so how the rigidity of a compact Hausdorff space simply means that if let's say E is compact Hausdorff with let's say one topology sigma, so E sigma is compact Hausdorff in the sigma topology. If you take a weaker topology, so if let's say omega is smaller than sigma, well, so what? How do compactness and Hausdorff play in terms of topologies? Obviously, if you take a smaller collection of open sets, compactness is still valid because you have fewer covers to check. And of course, alternatively, if you take a bigger topology with more open sets in it, Hausdorff is obviously still true. And the rigidity theorem says that the other thing must fail if it's strictly smaller. So if omega is smaller than sigma, then omega fails Hausdorff. The idea being that these things are rigid. If you take away any open sets at all, you're going to have to fail Hausdorff. There won't be enough sets to separate points anymore. And on the other hand, if you take a bigger one, larger, maybe lambda, or larger, is larger, that means strictly larger, than sigma, then lambda fails compactness. So that's the theorem that says that you cannot enlarge the topology without killing compactness, and you cannot diminish the topology without killing Hausdorff. And the proof of that, we've already done it once in another situation. It's what you said. When you have two different topologies, obviously there's a continuous map from one to the other. The one with the more open sets is continuously mapped into the one with fewer open sets because at inverse. And when you do that, to show that the bigger topology is actually included in the smaller one, you just take an open set here, take its complement, it will be compact, map it by the continuous function, you get a compact set, then you use the fact that it's Hausdorff over here so that compact sets are closed and the complement is open. So that's the proof. Why does it apply here? Well, it applies here because these things are both compact and Hausdorff. That's just an easy exercise. Well, one of them was a main theorem. The fact that the weak start topology on the maximal ideal space is compact, that followed from the Tychonoff theorem and the thing we mentioned last time, but I left as an exercise to show that it's the continuous linear functionals from a closed set in the sphere, unit sphere, of the dual space of X. So you get compactness for the topology on script M, and the fact that it's Hausdorff is just the definition of the weak topology. You can separate. You can always find something that separates the two in these examples anyways. And of course, in both of our cases, these spaces are compact Hausdorff. So they're both compact in Hausdorff, and of course the weak topology is weaker than the standard topology here. So the weak topology could be omega, the standard topology could be sigma. They're both compact Hausdorff spaces. They must coincide. That's the homeomorphism. We'll leave that. It probably would have been faster to give the string of implications, but this is what you should think of. You really should think of it that way. It's the fact that compact Hausdorff spaces can't be moved. Either strictly up or strictly down. Okay, so now, I think I wanted to keep that on the board. And the Gelfand transform. Finally, the Gelfand transform maps A d bar n one-to-one into the continuous functions on M, which is the same as the continuous functions on d bar n. And finally, this is the identity that takes, it's the identity when you, oh, it's the identity map that takes a function here to the same function over there, is the identity that takes A into itself. It's a subalgebra, right? So it's the, I mean, C of D, this sits here, and A is subalgebra, and the Gelfand transform. Under this identification of the maximal ideal space with D bar, it just, it's the identity. No, it's not close. No, it's definitely not dense.
Doesn't have to be dense also.
No, it's not closed. In fact, the general case is really without any information other than what's in the structure of it by the definitions, which is the important part. But in general, the Gelfand map, I mean, I don't know that you can say much about it. It's not one-to-one. It's not onto. It doesn't have closed range. It is a homomorphism. However, it has all these definitions attached to it so that in specific instances you can... In general, I don't think... Yeah, it's not some sort of magic bullet that handles everything at once, because the general map can be bad in general. I mean, it can be just... that, anyways. So now we want to look at example 3, which, of course, is H-infinity of the disk. So there's no bar on it this time. So this is bounded analytic functions. On the disk. I just wanted to keep that up there so we could compare later. I forgot, though. There is something I wanted to do. That just reminded me. So, in fact, before we get going on the bounded analytic functions, this reminded me. So, remark. Even though this proof could not be used to show that the point evaluation map was onto, now that we know it's onto, and that the homeomorphism exists, we can actually show that if the Fn satisfy the same property they satisfied before, that is, the sum of the Fn bar squares was positive, that in fact we can find elements in the disk algebra, holomorphic ones that work here. We can do it. And that's important because that will eventually motivate what we do with H infinity. The fact we'll prove that it has no corona. So the remark is this. If F1 to Fn are contained in the disk algebra, satisfy the sum, or maybe I should just say satisfy, I'll write it like this. Fn p squared equals 1 to j equal to or greater than delta squared positive for all p, right? That's where we would have been led if we were trying to redo the other onto proof. Remember that there we said, suppose there's some maximal ideal that's not achieved as a point evaluation, then for every point in the space, there must be some fj in that maximal ideal that's not zero there, and then the compactness of d bar n would show that there are finitely many f's with this property. However, we could then write one in this way, which is not good enough to derive a contradiction, because it doesn't imply that one is an m. Nevertheless, we can show that one is an m in this case. So if satisfy this, then there exist g1, gn contained in a d bar, such that 1 is equal to the sum k equals 1 to n, or j, f j z. I should use z instead of t. Typical to use z in the polydisk. G j z. Well, actually, I mean, we shouldn't. We shouldn't call this at this point a corona theorem because what happened to the other one? I guess I should continue over here. Because after all, the corona theorem, we haven't got there yet, but the corona theorem simply is the assertion that the point evaluations are dense in the maximal ideal space. And in the two examples we have so far, we've shown that they're onto. So of course they're dense. So there is no corona in the two examples we have in hand so far. The only reason I'm going to prove this remark is because it will, the analog of it for H infinity will be important. It's not important here. Well, it's an interesting theorem. But it's not crucial to show that, to show the absence of a corona. How do we prove that? Well, suppose you can't do it. So suppose that maybe this will be my notation for the ideal generated. Suppose that it's not everything. So the ideal generated by these particular f's, what is that going to be? That's just going to be this collection of all sums of this form. That's the ideal generated by the fj's. Therefore, it's not going to contain one. Oh, suppose the ideal generated by these things doesn't contain one. That's equivalent to saying it's not all of everything. Then maybe I should call it J. Keep it faster. Then J is contained in some maximal ideal M. So here I guess we're using the axiom of choice in all of our cases. At least I don't know otherwise. I think it's still somebody should think about it and answer it, but you probably cannot get away with it. Oh, I was going to say something about that, and I lost track of that too. If we go back to the theorem about why it appears to be that we need the axiom of choice for the theorem that every ideal is contained in a maximal one, and why, like you would wonder, at least I wondered, why for the Hahn-Banach theorem we were able to get away with that in a separable space. You don't need the axiom of choice to do the extension. And the reason is because in the case of the Hahn-Banach theorem, there was this extra thing involved, the norm or the semi-norm, whatever you were using. We used a norm. And at every step, you had the same norm control. So at every time you expanded the set, the extension satisfied some norm control, some external norm control. The point of that was that when you took the closure, the thing persisted, the norm control persisted, just by continuity. So it was the fact that the closure behaved well, that the norm thing behaved well under the closure. Remember, the norm thing is the thing you're trying to preserve. The analog for ideals is bad, because not only is there no norm control, so this is where the proof goes wrong, the standard proof. If you look at, if you have some ideal J, and you want to add some point not in it, of course a non-invertible one, and you're going to do this in such a way that, of course, it's bigger than J, but you still don't want it to be all of the Banach algebra. Remember, of course, in a Banach algebra, you can have, these are all non-invertible elements, so is X. The ideal generated by them, of course, can be all of X. In fact, as I noticed this morning when I thought about it a little bit, if your Banach algebra is the scalar field, then you cannot write the unit as the sum of two non-invertible elements. Because zero is a non-invertible element, none others. In any other Banach algebra, you can always write the unit as the sum of two non-invertible elements. I guess this is totally trivial, but in a Banach algebra that's not the scalar field, we proved the other day that some spectrum must contain at least two points. Because if the spectrum consists of exactly one point, you can form an isometric isomorphism onto the scalar field. So some spectrum contains two points that are distinct. And then you simply look at, alpha minus beta times the unit is the sum of what? Alpha E minus X, or minus beta E minus X. Both of these things are non-invertible, because alpha's in the spectrum and beta's in the spectrum of X. And they add up to something which, now if you divide through by alpha minus beta, you get that the unit is the sum of two non-invertible elements. So, going back to here, if you do this expansion, then after you do this choice of points and take the closure of the thing, you want to show that it's maximal, that you can't add anything else. You can't add another non-invertible element. Well, so let M be this closure of the union of all these things that you've looked at. If you take something like this, if you take an X not an M, then you of course now want to show that it's equal to X. But all you can do by the construction is show that these things, there's a sequence of XNs that tend to X, all of these are the whole Banach algebra, and the Xn tends to X. But you cannot conclude, as far as I can see, that this thing is all of X. Because surely the unit is in, oh, maybe yn. Surely the unit is in each one of these things, but unfortunately it doesn't converge to, because these m's and y's don't have to have any control. They're not norm bounded. There's no control. I mean, the xn's could be getting. I mean, these are all non-invertible elements, and somehow their size could be getting smaller or whatever, and the y-ends have to get big, and there's no limiting process. And in my mind, at least, this defect leads me to conjecture, because this is what every arrogant mathematician does. If you can't prove it, it's got to be false. But anyways, that's what I suspect. Anyway, so let's, if somebody can answer that question for me or find an answer, that'd be great. It's not crucial, I guess, because we're stuck with using the axiom of choice, I guess, now in many ways. So J is contained in some maximal ideal M, using the axiom of choice. Thus, there is H in the maximal ideal space with kernel M, such that H tills J. In particular, H tills each of the FJs. And that contradicts this. I didn't tell you what the H was. So H, in our case, H is a point evaluation. We proved that all the H's are point evaluations. So what this means is that FJ at P, and this is for some P, there's a fixed P such that all of these are zero, and that contradicts R. I should have said Z, I guess, instead of P. Z, or some Z in D bar N, and that contradicts star. Okay, so that's useful. Given the fact that we did know that it was onto, that was the important part here, was to know that the H was actually a point evaluation. That said that we couldn't have had this without having that.
The word
is, no, we didn't use that.
Just the last line, how do they get the contradiction finally? After I have...
Oh, because what you do... Okay, maybe I should call it Z-naught. So thus there is H, which is point evaluation at Z-naught. So at Z-naught, all the FJs vanish. So therefore, the left-hand side is zero when Z is Z-naught. Only for that one point. We could have gone up there. So that's the remark. And now we can go to H infinity, but I guess this is a good time to take a 10-minute break. And then when we go to H infinity, we should be very quickly show that we won't get, of course, a homeomorphism anymore. It's not true. But we'll show that the image of the Galfan or the image of this phi, the point evaluations, is dense if and only if the analog of this sort of implication holds. That is, this thing implies, that is, that thing, star, implies this thing. So we'll show that the absence of a corona is equivalent to the implication star implies exclamation point. And then we'll start with proving that star implies exclamation point. We're using Gamelin's variation on Wolf's proof with a small twist. So 10 minutes. Hello. The light seems to have burnt out. But apparently it's working. So now I can't tell whether it's on or off unless I hear myself. So now we'll come back to example 3, H infinity. So first of all, B, map B into M, this is the maximal ideal space of H infinity, is 1-to-1 continuous but not onto. This is one of those annoying little things. It's probably a two-word proof that it's not onto. And maybe one of you can think of the two-word proof. I'll give you a 12-word proof. Something a little more than two. All I want to do is verify for you that the set of point evaluations in the open unit disk are not everything. The reason I'm grimacing is that I might be doing overkill here. So just pick a sequence of points, Zn, going off to 1 like this. If you look at the corresponding point evaluations, they must have a limit point because M is compact in the weak start topology. Limit point. They must have a the closure must contain, there must be some element in the closure of the set that's a, you know, I'm trying to be careful because it's not necessarily a metric space. Yeah, see, now I'm sort of doubting my own. If I can say limit point of these things, because I don't want to talk about nets because I can't even remember the definition of a net. But the idea is that there cannot be any other point evaluation which is in any, I guess every other point evaluation has its own little neighborhood far away from these guys as they go to the boundary. I'll just leave that as an exercise. You pick the Zn's going to a specific point, and if you have any W here, you can show that there's a neighborhood of W which avoids the tail of this sequence. Probably, I guess in this case, avoids the whole thing. And therefore, because the space is compact, there must be something attached at the end of it. And I don't know what I mean by attached now. I realize I can't say limit point. Whatever it is, it can't be a point evaluation inside. So that's not much of a proof. Okay, it's not a proof at all, but it's an idea. That reminds me of that Jack Black movie when Ben Stiller said that's not an invention, that's just an idea. Of course, in the movies, the idea became an invention. But okay. Question. If you believe that it's not onto, question then arises, what is it dense? Or is it dense? Is C of D dense in M? And again, since M isn't a metric space, I guess we can't talk about sequences, but it means it's a closure anyways. I think one can make this rigorous by just looking at the tails. Um, Because the compact sets, the intersection of compact sets is not empty. So what you do is you look at each tail of this sequence, take its closure. It's a compact set with the finite intersection property because they're decreasing. Therefore there exists an H in M, well, H contained in the intersection of the closures of the tails. Okay, so now it's a fixed proof. So you look at the closure of the point evaluations in the maximal ideal space. These are that's a sequence of compact sets with a finite intersection property. There's an H in there. I claim that H cannot be equal to phi of W, because if you take a particular W, you can see that for the Zn's far enough apart, you can find an F in the original H infinity space that separates the W from all those guys, and that'll do it. Okay. So yes, it is a rigorous proof. Although, like I said, it's probably a simpler proof somewhere. Okay, good. I'm glad this came up. So you don't have to talk about nets, just compact sets. And that works even in a non-metric space. So is phi of D dense in M? We claim that phi of D is dense if and only if. Well, okay, let me just say something. So again, I don't know this stuff well, but I've read Garnett's book and I believe what he says. If you look at L infinity, look at, first of all, little L infinity of the integers. Simplest Banach algebra one of the simplest Banach algebras around, right? The bounded sequences on the positive integers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's a Banach algebra. Its maximal ideal space is the Stone-Check compactification. There is not a single concrete example of an element in the Stone-Check compactification. There's uncountably many elements in it. Nobody can write down a single element, as far as I know. Now you look at capital L infinity of the circle with respect to Lebesgue measure, the usual L infinity. According to Garnett, again, there is not a single concrete example of a multiplicative linear functional on this thing. On H infinity, it's much more likely that you can come up with explicit examples because Hoffman wrote a book about it, but I haven't read it, so I don't know. But I'm just pointing out that in general, for L infinity versions of this, you can't come up with anything. They don't exist. I mean, at least that's what is written in the literature. For H infinity, it's probably likely that you can, but I don't know of an example. I'd have to go off and read a bunch of details about that. I mean, Hoffman has investigated very carefully the structure of the maximal ideal space of H infinity, but I don't know about it. Okay, we claim, for us, the important thing is, which we can now prove, is that phi is going to be dense if and only if the following criterion holds. It's going to effectively be star implies exclamation mark. But I'll write it out in terms of H infinity, just so it's clear. So there's a theorem that says that under certain cases the weak star topology is metrizable. It has to do with the separability of something. And I can't remember what. So it might be, if the original space is separable, then the weak star topology is metrizable. I think that's it.
But H infinity is not separable.
Right. Well, Okay, I don't know. There's more questions than there are answers. Okay, but now you've given me a reason to go back and answer the original question, is H infinity separable? Originally I wasn't going to bother because it wouldn't help with the axiom of choice anyways. But now it will play a role at least in helping with the matrizability. Although, anyway, we'll see. But I'm pretty sure that's the theorem though, that if the space X is separable, then the weak star topology is matrizable. Because you can use that separable set to construct a bunch of semi norms, add them up with 1 over 2 to the n, and you get a metric, I think. Okay, so the criterion is this. This is the criterion for density that we're going to prove. And it's whenever we have F1, Fn contains H infinity, such that n equals 1 to capital N, there exists G1 to Gn in H infinity. Such that one is in the ideal generated by the Fn's. And of course, if one is in the ideal generated by the Fn's, because the Gn's are bounded, you obviously have this. So this is if and only if. This. If we can prove the other way, I mean. Okay, so now we have to prove what? We have to prove phi of B is dense if and only if this thing holds. So what we're going to show is phi of B dense if and only if this holds. And this is really easy to prove. However, it involves, at least the way that I've written it out, it involves several, suppose this, assume this doesn't hold, because it's a complicated logical statement. And because of that complication of having multiple choices for what to do at every stage of the proof, I'm going to largely follow my notes, because otherwise I'll hopelessly get lost. It's really a simple proof, but having said that, it's not so easy to get it right at the blackboard. So, proof. So we'll suppose, first of all, that the criterion holds. And, in order to derive a contradiction, that density fails. We want to derive a contradiction. Okay. What's the basis for the weak star neighborhoods? So it's not that. So then, the conclusion is, then there is H in M, and there is H in the maximal ideal space, epsilon positive, and a finite collection of functions in H infinity. Such that the point evaluation, such that for every W in the disk, the point evaluation fails to belong to the following weak star neighborhood of H. Weak star neighborhoods, of course, are given by an epsilon and a collection of data in the SpaceX. So N here will be the following thing. It's the set of lambdas in a maximal ideal space such that, so lambda on phi j minus h on phi j should be less than epsilon. Right, so you're simply looking at the action of these finitely many phi j's on the space M, and you're asking that you're close when tested against the phi j's. Okay, so that's a typical neighborhood that forms a sub-basis for the, or actually a basis, I guess, for the open sets in the weak star topology. And this is the assertion that phi of W, that phi is not dense, because that means there must be something. So here's the D. So there must be something out here, some H in the M out here, with the property that there is this neighborhood N that misses the open disk. So that can look like that. Looks like that. Okay, for this. Then. Okay, so for each W in the disk, there exists some J such that Phij of W minus H of Phij equals or greater than epsilon. Right? One of these conditions must fail because Phi of W is not in here. So if you put phi of w in place of lambda, then of course this becomes phi j at w. This must fail for some epsilon. Otherwise, it would be in the neighborhood. And what does this say? This says that if you look at the function fj of z equals phi j of z minus the constant h of phi j. This says that Fj equals this satisfy. Well, I mean, I called this star before, so I hope you don't mind if I just maybe call it star prime and exclamation prime. And they satisfy star prime. First of all, they're holomorph, they're bounded holomorphic functions, and they satisfy this with delta equals epsilon. Right, because at least one of them is greater than epsilon squared, and the other ones are positive, non-negative. So, by the criterion which we're assuming, there exist GJs in H infinity such that 1 is equal to the sum Fj So by the criterion, there exists GJ such that this, but the FJs, I mean, the reason we look at these things is because the FJs are in the kernel of H. That was a key point of the construction that I forgot to mention as we went by. So yes, it's true that we get this thing to vanish, but the reason we had to subtract the right constant, we couldn't have just used these functions. You can't just use the phi j's themselves, because the phi j's themselves are not in the kernel of h. But if you subtract off the right constant, I should have emphasized this before, if you subtract off the right constant, then they become in the kernel. And this neighborhood says that they're still kind of big. So that is in the kernel of h. Sorry, it's, that's because the fj's are in the kernel of h, which is a maximal ideal. And this is the ideal generated by the fj's. So they're in kernel of h, and that's the contradiction. Or, if you like, just take h of this expression. You get 1 equals h of 1, and then you get the sum of zeros times whatever. Still zeros. You get 1 equals 0. That's the contradiction. Okay, so that's one way. The other direction is equally simple, as long as I copy it from my notes. So conversely, we do the same thing. So what did we just do? We suppose that the criterion holds. So we showed that the criterion implies the density. This time, we assume the density holds and that the criterion fails. That's the opposite. So now, assume if the dense in M, and in order to derive a contradiction, that the criterion fails. So this is the last of these abstract arguments. It will only last a couple of minutes. And then we get to what I find really some really interesting analysis, Wolff's proof of the Corona theorem. But this will finally reduce the Corona theorem to something which can be tackled by things that we have in analysis. Okay, so now we have it's dense and that the criterion fails. Oh, now we argue just, this is what it says here, now we argue just as we did in that remark earlier. So then, so if the criterion fails, then there exists F1 to Fn in H infinity satisfying star prime, but not exclamation mark prime. So in other words, the ideal generated by the Fn's is not the whole space. It's a proper ideal, hence contained in a maximal ideal. That maximal ideal is kernel of H. That means there's an H that kills everything in this ideal. In particular, the H kills the Fn, and then just as in the previous argument, well, here we don't have onto-ness, but we have density, so that'll show that we can get close to killing this. So there's a little extra wrinkle at the end. So it's almost the previous argument. So J, which is equal to the ideal generated by F1 to Fn, is not H infinity, implies J is contained, M equals kernel H, some H in the maximal ideal space. So then, of course, H of Fj equals zero for these finitely many functions. If H were a point evaluation, we'd be done, because that would violate star prime. However, since we're assuming that phi of d is dense in M, we can violate star prime arbitrarily closely. I mean, amounts to the same thing. Okay. So now we have to use that same neighborhood we had before. Since C, D is dense, there is, for each little n equal to or greater than 1, a point W sub n in the disk such that the point evaluation is in that standard neighborhood of H. I'll write it down again. So here's D, and there's now this sequence of points WN such that phi of WN lies in that same neighborhood with a small modification now. It's the set of lambdas in M such that, I don't know if it's on the board anymore. Yeah, there it is. So it's lambda of, now we want to use Fj. Lambda of Fj minus H of Fj. Less than, we want to use 1 over n as the epsilon this time, and that's it. So this is a typical weak star neighborhood of H. And since point evaluations are dense, we can find one of these guys in here. But now what? H of Fj is 0. And the phi of Wn is in here. That means that we can put... So thus, phi of Wn on Fj minus 0 is less than 1 over n. Right, because these constants are 0. That was the point of getting the H to annihilate the maximal ideal, or to annihilate the ideal generated by the F. And now we're done, because this is Fj Wn. So what that says is that the left-hand side of star prime is equal to or less than capital N times that thing squared. And that goes to 0 as N goes to infinity. And you'll notice that we're not changing the Fj's here. They stay fixed. It's only the epsilon that changes. So you're allowed to do this. The capital N stays fixed. And that's the contradiction. Okay. I must confess that even after I look at the proof, I still, I can understand it line for line why the criterion is equivalent to phi of D being dense, but I don't have a good picture in my mind. I will alert you to the fact that we will use this criterion not just for H infinity, but for some other Banach algebras as well, and I won't go through this again. It works, but it's equally non-illuminating, in my opinion. I mean, sure, you have to go through this, and it's good to see it, but it's hard for me to simulate it. Okay, so now we start the fun stuff. Put that out of the way. Okay, now we want to show that H infinity has no corona. So that was Carlson's famous theorem in the early 60s. We'll leave the criterion up there. Bernstein's Corona Theorem is that M minus the closure of point evaluations, which is typically dubbed the corona, simply because D embeds into M, and we know that all of D is contained in M, and there could be stuff at the boundary or maybe beyond. And the Hardison's theorem, of course, asserts that D is dead, so there's nothing beyond. There's no corona. So, empty. So, in other words, by what we just proved up there, it's enough to establish the criterion. So proof, it suffices to establish the criterion. So, let's suppose a star holds. Yeah, with a small variation by Gamelin and a tiny twist that I will do. I'll point it out when I get there. It's really very little. But yes, this is Tom. Basically, it's Tom Wolfe's idea. Up until Tom Wolfe came along, this proof was incredibly difficult. At least I think it was incredibly difficult. Although the construction that was used in it apparently is also useful for Douglas algebras, for which there is no other simpler proof. So it's still a very important tool. However, Tom Wolfe, this is one of those amazing things. I don't think Tom Wolfe ever published the proof. It just appeared in Garnett's book. Kind of amazing. Hey, because it's such a huge thing. Anyways, so suppose star prime holds, then we can write the same as we did for the continuous functions. You can write 1 is equal to a sum of fj's times something, where the somethings, of course, aren't going to work because they won't be holomorphic this time, just as they weren't before either. So then we can write 1 equals the sum j equals 1 to n fjz, and then over here fjz bar over the sum, I actually use different index fk squareds. Okay, so that's just that's the trick we used for the continuous functions on a compact Hausdorff space before, because if the fj's were continuous functions and if this was bounded below, then this thing over here is still a continuous function, and we were done. Proof was done. In other words, that would be exclamation mark. So let's call these things cj. And also let's introduce the notation F phi. So this is inner product in Cn. Actually, no, it's just not inner product in Cn, it's the dot product. Dot product. I don't want to put bars on the... So dot product in Cn. This will just make it easier to do the algebraic manipulations. So we wish to find, of course, I'm just repeating this, gj and h infinity. Notice that the phi j's are in L infinity, but they're not holomorphic. We wish to find gj and h infinity such that, and then what we're looking for is 1 is the dot product of f and g. So now there's two things that look slightly unmotivated. Now, books get around this by saying, oh, this is motivated by the causal complex, which, in my opinion, is also unmotivated. But anyway, so I think it's actually simpler just to not introduce the complex. And there's just two places where you have to do a little something out of a hat. Here's the first one. We try G, the vector G, it's going to, of course, be the vector phi. Why is it going to be the vector phi plus an error? The vector phi, of course, is because we want to preserve... Maybe from here I should have said... We have 1 is equal to f dot phi, and phi is L infinity. So the fact that we have f dot phi is equal to 1, all we need to add here is something for which f dot it is 0. Now, f dot something should be 0. What could you try? Well, you could try I don't know, this is not all that unmotivated. You could try a skew symmetric matrix acting on F. Why? Because if I take F dot AF, what is that? That's the quadratic form corresponding to the matrix X. Now, it should be fairly on the tip of your cortex that quadratic forms of a matrix are identically zero if and only if the matrix is skew symmetric. I mean, you just take the transpose, and because it's minus itself, you get the thing is equal to its minus, which means it must always be zero. So skew symmetric matrices are the things which give you identically zero quadratic forms. So therefore, if A is skew symmetric matrix, well, I'm not taking bars. We're not doing inner products Hilbert spaces.
The transpose of A?
Yeah, transpose is minus A. Because then, okay, so we try this, since, of course, if you look at F dot G, that's equal to phi dot G plus F dot AF, and that's 1 plus 0. And the reason this is 0 is this is a dot product, so if you flip it around, you get the same thing. But if you take the A over here, you get minus it. So it is equal to minus itself. First of all, skew symmetric matrices always have zeros on the diagonal, and they look like this. And obviously a quadratic form here, you get zeta 1, zeta 2 with a minus sign, and here's zeta 2, zeta 1 with a plus sign. I mean, so it's really, really simple. So at least this particular formalism, oh, and of course all of these things are functions of z. That is a function of z. Now, of course, phi is not analytic. F is analytic, so since we want G to be analytic, A, of course, cannot be analytic itself. It has to somehow compensate. And now that I don't think is terribly unmotivated to try this. It seems reasonable. The next thing, the form of A that we try is a specific rank 1 skew symmetric matrix. It is a little trickier, but it works very simply. So the final step in this detour around the causal complex is to tell you what form of matrix A that actually works. We choose, and this is where the D bar equation comes in, of course. It's not trivial to do this, of course, but so we choose capital A, anti-symmetric, or We choose, I mean, it's going to be automatically anti-symmetric. So we choose capital A such that the following happens. DDZ bar of the matrix, which is just you take DDZ bar of each of the component entries, satisfies the following equation. Remember, we have this vector phi. Well, we look at the vector phi times d phi dz bar primed. This is transpose. So what do I mean by this? Remember, the phi is a vector. I write vectors as columns. So it's this thing, if you want to write it all out. Right? And this thing is a matrix. It's an n by n matrix. That's extremely simple. Right? It's just a rank one matrix. And everything is multiples of this row or multiples of that column. Minus the other way around. So the other way around is d phi dz bar times phi transpose. So all you do for the other one is you just write it the other way around. You put the ddz bars here, and you don't put them there. The reason you do this, because now we can, well, first of all, we choose A such that it satisfies this. The question is, well, how do we know there is such an A? That's where the Tom Wolfe cleverness comes in. But if we can solve that equation with a capital A like that, then we'll see what conditions we need. If you have a matrix-valued function that satisfies that equation, then you're done. You just plug it in. Then it works, because dg, dz bar, is the phi part, plus, now remember, f is analytic, so when you apply the product rule here, you only hit the a, dA, dz bar, the matrix applied to the column f, and then we use the fact that it satisfies the equation. So dA dz bar is equal to phi dz bar transpose F, that's that matrix applied to F, minus d phi dz bar phi transpose applied to F. So this is, well, you repeat this part, phi dz bar. And now here we get the column vector phi times the inner product. D phi dz bar with F. D phi, let me finish this first. Phi dz bar phi F. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So when I'm applying the product rule, here, there's no term A DFDZ bar because DFDZ bar is zero. All the entries in that column are analytic functions. Now we're done, because phi F is one. So it cancels with that. What about this thing? It's a different color. What about this thing? That thing is equal to ddz bar of df. Same reasoning that you just mentioned. When you apply the, this is dot product. When you apply the product rule, when the ddz bar hits the f, you get nothing. So it's just that term. But f phi is 1. So this is ddz bar of 1, it's 0. So there's nothing left. So that's the causal complex, what it looks like for us. So, life is not so simple. Let me just make a couple of words. I won't write anything else because it's actually noon. What else do we need about this solution, capital A? Well, certainly, if the ddz bar of A equals that, then we end up with the g's being analytic. Because the idea now is this is zero. So the elements g1, g2, up down to gn are all analytic functions. They also, however, have to be in H infinity. They have to be bounded. This is going to be more problematic. What we're going to do in the actual implementation of this scheme is we start off with what are called the corona data. That's the Fs. That's the corona data. They're bounded analytic functions. We use that R less than 1 trick to expand them a little bit beyond the closure of the disk so that we can assume that those functions are actually analytic in a neighborhood of D bar. And they still satisfy the same L infinity norm bound. So we have this family of functions which are slightly expanded, all with the same uniform bound on their L infinity norms. For those X functions, those F sub R's, we're going to do this procedure, and we want to be able to find a solution matrix A that is also has the property that on the boundary it's bounded by the same, or at least a fixed multiple of the same corona data bound. So this soup norm bound of the vector F that we start with the corona data will be something that carries throughout the entire proof. At every stage, we have to have whatever we're looking at bounded by that thing, at least on the circle. So we're going to have A, of course, will be continuous up to the boundary because things are, the data is C infinity, but we'll want to be able to prove that the L infinity norm of A on the boundary is controlled by the original corona data bound. And that's what's hard, because if we get a uniform control, then in the end, we let the R go to 1, which means we shrink the things back. You use a normal families argument, you get an analytic collection of functions, which still works point-wise, so you're done. To get this analytic bound, however, is extremely hard, and this is where we use, it looks similar, it's a duality proof that looks kind of similar to the proof we use for interpolation, where you get some infimum controlled by equaling some soup, and you test over H1 functions, and you use the factorization theorem. H1 is the product of H2 functions. And then you use a whole bunch of Carlson measure theory together with one, I think, really clever observation of Tom Wolfe. We'll see that next time. So I won't say anything more about it. But that's the basic idea. We have to be very careful about the L infinity norms of everything. And that's where all the problem is. If we didn't have to worry about that, we'd be done. Yeah, we have to solve this equation, ddz bar a.